Now, I was going to start today with a really serious story, but two things have to be commented on. Being a rock star librarian really doesn't get you much. I just want to point that out. And two, I'm a little worried to talk to this group because I have never heard so much laughter during an assessment discussion in my life. That is an impressive feat. All right, so now let me put on my serious face. January 28, 2011. During the Egyptian uprising, protesters took to the streets all over Egypt. The one we saw most on the news was Tahrir Square. But it happened in every major city, and it happened in the city of Alexandria. Protesters would swarm the square, would swarm the streets, calling for justice, calling for equal treatment under the law, calling for freedom. And what happened on January 28th, 2011 at 6 p.m. is during this, all civil services were withdrawn. All police withdrew from the street. All military withdrew from the street, simultaneously releasing every prisoner in every prison around Alexandria. Rapists, murderers, robbers, released onto the streets in the midst to create chaos. And it succeeded. Looters and people rebelling protesters went from government building to government building to tear them down. Went and lit them on fire. Went and destroyed them. And what happened that evening is some of those looters then turned their eyes to the Library of Alexandria. The Library of Alexandria was built approximately 6 years beforehand to remember the famous ancient Library of Alexandria by the Mubarak administration. There was not one building more associated in all of Alexandria with Mubarak than that building. His wife sat on the board of the library. And as the looters went to go tear it down as they had other government buildings, protesters joined hand in hand, women, men, and children, to surround the library to protect it. By the time the protests were done, by the time the regime had fallen, not one window was broken, not one rock was thrown against its walls. And the question that leads me to is why? In Kenya, they can't build public libraries fast enough. They build them and they build them in every major developed area. Where they can't get cars, they build carts. Where they take mules and they take thousands of books on carts into rural Kenya. In northern desert of Kenya, they can't even get the carts. And so what they've begun doing is tacking the books on camels to take it into remote villages and tribes. And what happens is they come into a remote village, they unroll the carts, they put up tents, they put down things, they put down tarps, and children and women and men absorb it, take it in, read it, find it the highlight of what's going on. The camel is the most essential animal to these tribes. It's their source of transportation. It's their source of labor. Frankly, their dung is a source of power for their stoves. And when they pass away, it's a source of food. It has now become another essential factor, which is their link to learning and knowledge. In the hills of Colombia, the Biblio Library was begun by Carlos, he's the one on the donkey, who was a teacher. And he realized that as good a teacher as he could be in the classroom, when his children left the classroom, they didn't have any books to study. They didn't have any materials to continue their education. And so he began, out of his home, loaning out materials. And when that wasn't enough, he realized that some people walked days and days to go to school. He got his donkeys, Alfa and Beto, and he strapped books onto them to take them into rural Colombia. Why? Why did they save the Library of Alexandria? Why does this man feel compelled enough to get on a cart? Why do they feel it's important that the essential camels bring library services into these rural and remote tribes? This was the question that started me out. Because it turns out that the answer to most of this is because the communities value what they bring. And it is not books. They value what they bring in, that they bring education. They bring knowledge. In many cases, they bring opportunities. Now, what's happening with the Library of Alexandria is that grandmothers and mothers and daughters who never had access to the education that they needed now come in and ask, what is Facebook? What is Twitter? And the Library of Alexandria has become the broadest bandwidth connection in the entire country. And why, when they went to protest, when they surrounded the buildings, they asked the head librarian if they could put a 30-foot-long protest flag that the protesters would touch every day as they went out to fight a crooked regime. Why? Because the librarians did their job. Every day they did their job. I tell this story to new librarians, which is who I teach, and they get scared because they sit there and go, I'm not up for armed insurrection. That wasn't why I'm getting this degree. And I say, neither were those librarians. They did their job. Every day they went in and they did their job. But they didn't see their job as the building. They didn't see their job as the administration. They didn't see their job as maintaining donkeys. They saw their job as learning and knowledge and building a community. And that why question in libraries has led me to ask that why question larger. How does that work in community colleges? How does that work in other settings? How does that work in government? How does that work in public administration? How do we look at building this type of community around learning and knowledge and reinforce and reify these organizations? So what I want to talk about is a little bit about why we need to talk about building communities and not building students. Or building communities and not necessarily building buildings. We build those to help us do something. They're tools. In library land, we love having discussions about, are we about the books? Are we about the buildings? Are we about... That discussion's done. We're about impact. We're about what our effect is. Once again, Middle States, I hate to keep bringing up a sore topic, right? 20 years ago, Middle States wants to know how many students you have, how many they graduate, how long did it take them to graduate. They want what are called outputs. They want things you can count. But no, that wasn't good enough for them because we figured out how to do that too easily. So now it's all about outcomes. Yeah, they graduated, but did they know anything more than when they started the process? In libraries, this is really interesting because in libraries, we for so long have felt that we provide raw material to a process that faculty will somehow take advantage of. Right? Oh, here are books and materials. What impact did you have? Not my job. Now libraries are sitting there going, what's the percentage of my budget that led to that A? What percentage of my budget led to that C? And it's a weird, different world. But I'm going to argue that if we think about our role, librarians, faculty, technologists, leadership, IT, around this concept of community building and community learning, we can begin to get a handle on that. Because what we've seen over the past 100 years is that life has changed for us. So, for example, at the top, when we talk about pedagogy and learning, right, what we used to talk about was teaching. We used to think of education as a process whereby you were empty buckets and I was the professor lobbing bricks of knowledge into your buckets. And all of us who have dealt with students realize that some buckets were wider than others. Right? And if your bucket was just not wide enough for my brick, that's your problem. So this concept where we went from sage on the stage to guide on the side, whatever you want to talk about it, coaching, you want to talk about more interaction, you want to talk about participation, whatever it is, we have shifted to the idea that somehow people come to us as this sort of generic template that we can fill up, to the idea that we have learners who create a personal learning network around them. And it really hurts that I spent all my time getting a PhD so I could teach you, and the truth is, you're learning from the guy next to you. Why? Because I like him better, right? Because he makes more sense, because he can do it in an electronic way, whatever it is. Now we begin to realize the networks that people build up, the social networks, and I'm not talking Facebook and Twitter, I mean literally who we talk to on a regular basis, has as much impact on their learning as however dynamic a speaker I am. So we've changed how we thought about learners. They've gone from this sort of empty shell, thank God they're here, that we can save them from their ignorance, to the idea that here are people that must actively learn. I cannot teach you anything. You can only learn something. The best I can do is direct your attention properly. The best I can do is engage in conversation and deal with your questions. And in libraries, this middle row, we've dealt with the same thing. We used to be all around the stuff. I mean, let's face it, university learning used to be around the stuff. When you took a faculty position, the question was, how many volumes do you have? Because I'm going to read them all. I don't know. And what's there to... I mean, this is real. I mean, I hate to talk out of term, so librarians, close your ears. There is a rating for the academic library, ARL, Academic and Research Libraries, that rates how good you are, right? One of the factors is volume count, how much stuff you've got. Now, some libraries playing this game, particularly small ones that want to move up, you know what they do? They make arrangements to buy the books that are discarded by other libraries to shelve. This is the wrong way of thinking about things. The person with the most stuff wins. No. Right? So we've begun to change and say, you know, we're not about the books and the bindings and the indexes and the abstracts and the this and the catalog, whatever. We're about knowledge. We're about what we can get out of this, how we can turn this into something that people can create the next great understanding about. And knowledge rests within people, not within those things. And IT, technology, has shifted. Technology in the 60s and in the 70s was all about big iron. Was all about the biggest computers we could build. And IT departments loved it because they lived in one building that no one would bother them, and they got refrigeration, which was even better during the summer. Right? And they would send out some terminals with green type on black text, and the only technology question they ever had was, did you jiggle the wire or flip the switch? Right? IT's changed a bit, right? IT, we now expect to be more about what our users do. Where are they? Where's our Wi-Fi network? Can they get on? Is this secure enough to do that? How do we prevent people from bringing in their own hubs, damn them, and setting up their own network? Right? It's a very different world. To work in IT now, you have to deal with 5,000 different platforms in 5,000 different places with 5,000 different people who are out to get you. Right? When we first started with IT systems and we built the admission systems, we built the financial systems, we built the student tracking systems, what we would do is drag people from the offices of admissions and HR, whatever, and we'd say, now, first press F1. Why? Because you have to hit F1 first. Right? And then hit F5. Why? Are you listening to me? Because if you stop me, we're never going to get to F12. Right? Now it's like, hit F12, like anyone hits a key anymore. Click on this button. Click on the green button. It doesn't look green on my screen because I'm using, you're using Firefox. No, I'm using Chrome. No, I'm using Internet Explorer. No, I still am on IE1, whatever it is, right? But what's very interesting is if you look at these segments, if you look at our learning segment, if you look at our sort of information segment, if you look at our sort of IT segment, is what we haven't yet truly come to grips with is that we're actually all heading in the same direction, right? Now, some people ask, why did this shift occur? Particularly this one. I get a lot of this. Is it that people in 2010 are fundamentally different than people in 1910? Why do we have to deal with these strangers now? Did we learn something? Well, we see, first of all, a changing labor market. That we are now preparing people for jobs that never existed before, and those jobs require a different way of learning. Right? Do you guys have public safety? Right? I don't want you training public safety by having them read a textbook. I would rather you actually show them how the gun works or show them how the equipment works. Same with physical therapy, right? So first, I was just in the Cleveland Clinic last week, checked in as a patient. It was delightful. And they said, well, we have a medical school at Case Western. Can we bring some doctors in training in? And I said, sure, why not? Turns out they're second year med students, and he was teaching them how to use that eye thing. Where, you know, the doctor goes up to your eye and looks around? So here I am with second-year medical students, the first time they've ever touched a device, going, getting that close to my eye. And I'm like, God, it'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. We see a change in the education market, right? It's increasingly competitive. We now have to, frankly, reach out to students in ways that we didn't before. We have to market to students. We have to accommodate students in different ways. I mean, we have to think about, oh, it's not good enough to have a cafeteria, now it's got to have a Starbucks next to it, et cetera, et cetera. We also have to deal with the fact that it's increasingly expensive, and that leads to a natural reaction on the part of those students to say, you know, what am I getting my money's worth? I had a great colleague, Jeff Katzer, who once said, you don't pay me to teach. I do that for free. You pay me to grade you. Students don't get that. Right? An expansion of student population. We're crossing demographics. We're crossing learning styles. We're crossing support systems. We were just having a conversation before this about, for example, the expansion of the military. You're getting folks coming from all different parts of the country over to a base that have never had to sort of deal with snow in upstate New York. And now you're having to figure out, how do we teach these folks? Is it different? Is it the same? Technology-enabled change. We can just do stuff that we never thought of before. Right? I can, in this classroom, shame you into listening to me, or at least pretending to. Right? Turn off that laptop. Stop doing that. Whatever. When they're online, I don't know what they're doing. It's like one screen my class and the other screen a gambling site. What is it? Which one will win? I don't know. A reversal of scarcity from information to attention. We used to live in a world, once again, I'm talking hundreds of years, where information was scarce, where knowledge, when access to professors and smart people and science and laboratories and classrooms was scarce. We lived in a world where the buckets, if you didn't learn by being a bucket, you took yourself out of the system. You didn't go past eighth grade. You didn't go past high school. And frankly, we lived in the labor market where that was okay because manufacturing was sitting to take you on. We now live in a world where no one can survive that. And we understand that the bucket's wrong. I'm going to miss this. Ken Robinson used to talk about the process of education. He says, it's interesting, the higher you go in education, the less of your body you use. He said, you know, when you're a kindergartner, you're dancing, you're hanging out, you're cutting stuff, you're hitting your friend, you're eating paste. By second grade, we have you sitting still, we have you sitting at a desk, we have you filling out information. By eighth grade, all you do is sit, and you move from classroom to classroom. And if you look at the pinnacle of that system, the PhD, right, by that point, all we are is in your brain, slightly to the left, with a body to take you from meeting to meeting, right? So we have to suddenly deal with the fact that, wait, we have to use the whole body sometimes, right? And we understand differently how people learn. So as I mentioned, we're all heading into a very interesting and different trajectory, and it's challenging. It's challenging not to just people who look at the 100-year scale, because now it's happening on a year-to-year scale. But what's interesting is none of these groups have necessarily realized yet that we're all actually heading towards the same conclusion. That this person is living in a network where they're accessing resources, right? We've updated our organizations. We're now cool and hip and sleek and pretty icons. But we all look at these people as if they're different people, right? The technology folks call them users. And frankly, student users, staff users, faculty users, president users, they're just users, which means they're stupid and they want to break my stuff. I know, it's not quite fair. They just want to break your stuff. All right. Right? The tutoring and guidance service, our pedagogy, says they're students. They're here to learn. So they don't read and they don't write. Do you guys still get to blame high schools for them not writing, or is that just a four-year gig? All right. And our libraries still call them patrons because apparently we expect them to pay us to paint oil paintings. Right? And so what we need to think about is, you know, we're moving to a world where increasingly these kinds of words are starting to slip into our vocabulary. They're customers. They're consumers. This is, to me, the most dangerous thing we are doing. Your students are not customers or consumers. Think about this. This is a fundamentally different relationship. Colleges have a fundamentally different relationship with students than almost any other organization. In the first 4 to 10 years of their careers, once they graduate, they are depending upon you for their reputation. I have a degree, and I'm certified. From 10 to 60, you are dependent upon them for your reputation. The money they bring in, the alumni they do, the stories that you can tell, whether they come back as faculty, what they prepare. That means that they're not customers or consumers because, frankly, Ford does not hope that people who once bought a Tundra comes back and they do the advice, but they're not in the same relationship. They're not having the same customer relationship. I once had someone talk about social networking. They're like, you know, can I just watch a show without having to tweet about it? Well, there. Good Lord, I'm trembling. All right. Don't mind me. You make me nervous. All right. What I want to say is that that customer and that consumer word represents a worldview. A worldview is how we see the world, right? So this is a worldview we may have been familiar with. We like to make fun of it every so often. Kuhn talked about it as a paradigm. But worldviews are things that we never pay attention to. They're built in, they're assumptions, and yet they shape how we see the world and the questions we can ask. For example, if you believe the world is flat, science can occur. How wide is it? How deep is it? What's under us? What's above us? How do we get this? All this other stuff. We never ask the question, is it flat? Because it is. These are our worldviews we bring into it. Community college, what's the worldview, right? Four-year research colleges, our worldview is that brilliant faculty are busy being brilliant and students are welcome to tag along. Right? Those are worldviews. We have stereotypes around them, but they're based on our worldviews. They change the questions we can ask. So I would like to, for a moment, see if you guys, how you guys feel about worldview. And I'm going to ask you two questions. The first one is, what 18th century inventor, 19th century inventor, developed the basis of the electrical grid that we use today? This is interesting. Edison is what you get most of the time, right? Because Edison developed lots of stuff, the technologies, the famous inventor, all this other stuff. Turns out that Edison, when he worked around technology, when he developed the light bulb and he was going to build the grid, was going to build it around something called direct current, DC, which your battery in your car gives you. The problem is that DC, direct current, which means when you turn a light switch on, electricity has to be pushed from the power station into your house to the bulb. When that electricity passes through, it encounters resistance, which creates heat, and it doesn't go very far. It dissipates. So Edison, for New York City, would have had to build a power station every 10 blocks. Nikola Tesla, who you don't hear about, well, you do now because it's like he's the new nerd god, but Nikola Tesla actually said, no, that's not how you do it. You base it on AC, alternating current. That is, what happens is you charge the electrical grid, and instead of electricity having to travel all the time, it goes back and forth. And that motion is actually what powers lights and things like that. But when you say Edison, and once again, most people say Edison. Why? Electricity, light bulb, Edison, part of our worldview. Next question. Who discovered the world was round? Oh, you guys are too smart. What did you learn in third grade who discovered the world was round? The misconception that people at the time of Columbus believed in a flat earth was listed by the Historical Society of Britain as the second most common error in history. I asked this question to my undergraduates, juniors and seniors last year, and they almost universally said Columbus. Right? Columbus, it was Aristotle who looked up at the moon and said, hey, it's curved. We just didn't know how round it was. But those are part of our worldview. It's things that we don't question, that we learn, that make sense to us. And unless we're challenged, unless we don't walk off the side of the earth, we don't question them. And so part of it, you move ahead, is your assessment. The assessment's a great example. You are going to get the data for the questions you ask. Are they the right questions? Right? Back to the idea of outcomes versus outputs. I can give you all the numbers of how many people checked out books or attended classes. But those, turns out, we now say, they're the wrong questions. We need to change the questions. We need to change the worldview. So this consumer and customer worldview is a dangerous worldview, I would argue, for higher education. Why? Because you are not a user. You are not a user. You are not a customer or a consumer. You are a participant in control of your information and the world around you and those you seek to serve. You are a member of a community. And so are those that you serve. If anyone treated you like a consumer, if anyone treated you simply as the user, you're wrong, get out of the way. We always want to introduce a computer system that had user error. Please replace user. Right? If we treated you as someone who simply came in, put in their time, and left, How much loyalty to the organization? How much attention would you give to innovation? How much would you struggle and try new things? And why do we think that students would do differently? You come in, you take your class, you leave. We're community-oriented. And that's why I have to say, when I was preparing this presentation, I got extremely, extremely excited about the opportunities at community college. I'm going to admit that I'm an outsider, and this will be uninformed, ignorant stuff, so please ignore it. But this community means a lot to me. Because what we're seeing in libraries, and increasingly what we're seeing in local governments, what we're seeing is this outreach and community-driven model changes things. We're not student-centered, we're community-centered. When that student looks at you and says, you can't give me an F, I paid you, which, by the way, is how the education system used to work back in the 1900s. Right? There's a reason that we talk about tenure and we talk about pay systems, because we went away from Harvard. The president of Harvard's medical school in the early 1900s wanted to implement a written exam for every graduate of Harvard Medical School. And the faculty, who were paid directly by students, stood up, protested, and prevented it because they said 90% of our class would fail it. Yay. Right? So we're not student-centered, because students are part of a rich, complex milieu around the community. They have needs and rights, but they also have things that they need to be shaped and taught. This idea of who gets to control the world. There's a curriculum development. I think students should say a lot about curriculum development. I think the industries in which they're going in probably have a lot more to say about curriculum. Right? I mean, I get library science students, first year. I don't need to know this. Yes? How do you have a clue what you need to know on the first day of getting prepared for a new job? Or you don't want to learn this. I'm going to make you. Now you can't make them learn. Go back. I know. Redundant. Anyway. What that means is that we have to understand that learning and people are inherently social beasts. Once again, this isn't Twitter. This isn't Facebook. And this also isn't the classic sense of social as in, I need lots of friends. We know there are plenty of people who need very few friends. Or want very few friends. Or want to touch people. Whatever it is. But it means that they learn through conversation. Where you learn is you learn through conversation. What does that mean? Well, when you look at learning theory and pedagogy, what you start with is you've got someone who needs to learn something. This is different than someone we need to teach. And it starts because they have this hole in their knowledge, hole in their head. Once again, I know it sounds like buckets, but that's not where we're going. It means as they're walking through the world somehow, they're encountering something they're missing. I wish I knew how that worked. It could be this little, right? It could be, God, if only I knew what Britney Spears' birthday was, my life would be better. Okay. Or it could be this big. I'm really tired of working at this burger joint. I would much rather be doctor, whatever it is. So they encounter this hole. And that hole comes from this whole network, this worldview of how they see the world. How they see facts, organizations, whatever, in different relationships. And they encounter a problem where they can't deal with it. I don't know how to get over this hump. And so what do they do? What they're going to do is over time they're going to explore the domain where they're going to talk to people. They're going to talk to lots of people, including a lot of talking to themselves. Now I know this sounds really twisted because we hope that people don't talk to themselves out loud and in public. But in fact, if you just sat there and said, do you think lunch is coming? Can I go yet? Who were you talking to? Right? We talk to ourselves all the time. Have you ever been in one of those situations where you're like down the street and the bagel place is there and the coffee place is there and you sit there and go, I'm going to get coffee. No, that'd be messy. And you literally turn yourself around on the street. So you're arguing with yourself. We do this all the time. Right? And how do we do it? We do it with the language we use. And we seek agreements. Oh, that makes sense. That's how it happens. That's how it happens. And these agreements, this sort of, this is how the world works, developed by the learner, it may have some relation to an artifact or the people we learn, but those disappear. Where did you learn that a cloud was made of water vapor? I have no idea. It is probably third graders, probably some science textbook. But clouds are made of water vapor, right? So I had that agreement, but I sort of lost track of where it came from. This happens all the time, right? Oh, I have this great story. And it wasn't your story. You stole it from someone who stole it from someone who stole it from someone. But you sort of forgot that, right? So now it's your, kind of like cooking recipes. When you should, if you make it three times and show up at parties, it's your recipe then, right? But what this means is that over time, what you're left with is these network set of agreements. And this is very interesting. It's not linear, right? If you think about it for a minute, we learn in a linear way, but we don't store what we learn in a linear way. What do I mean? Tell a joke. If you tell a joke, it's based on a pattern. I'll give you an example. A woman goes into a green market, says, I need 5 pounds of broccoli. The produce manager says, I'm sorry, ma'am, we don't have broccoli, but we have a lovely cauliflower. She goes, that's fantastic. I'll take the broccoli. He goes, well, I'm sorry, we don't have broccoli, but I got these green beans. How about the green beans? She goes, oh, those are great green beans, but I'll just take the broccoli. He goes, ma'am, we don't have broccoli, but we have these carrots. Oh, those are great carrots, but I'll have the broccoli. He goes, ma'am, can you spell cat as in catastrophic? Sure, C-A-T. Can you spell dog as in dogmatic? Sure, D-O-G. Can you spell frick as in nuclear? She goes, hey, I'm sorry, frick as in broccoli? She goes, hey, there is no frickin' broccoli. She goes, that's what I've been trying to tell you. Now, here's the trick, even if I didn't slightly screw up the punchline. You probably won't remember the punchline. How many people have gone to tell that damn joke and they forget the punchline? Why? Because your brain loves patterns. Oh, ask about the broccoli, to refuse the broccoli, ask about the broccoli. And then the end, oh, I know. That's why we don't remember good jokes. Because our brains learn with this pattern recognition. But we don't, when you break the pattern, it's funny, but it makes it hard to remember. Right? That's this network of connections that we pull together. And then you're going to say, oh, I learned that joke at the SUNY thing. Oh, I also, it was a bright day that day. I need to get my oil changed. Whatever, you combine these things. All right? So that's what I mean when I say we learn through conversation. And that means what we need to be doing is preventing creating communities of conversation around the things we want people to learn. Right? What are some of the implications for higher ed? And I don't just mean community colleges, because once again, I'm not here. This is your environment you know a lot more about. But I'll tell you, what we're dealing with at Syracuse is, first of all, faculties are communities of practice. And that means the old model of hire the best faculty regardless of whether they will talk to you when they take the job is not working anymore. We're talking about moving from schools to schools of thought, where people collaborate. When you look at some of the most amazing academic scholarly output, you think about things like the Chicago School in sociology. The reason the Chicago School is important is that the professors actually talk to each other. So that means we need to allow time and tools for those interactions, and we need to reward collaboration. This whole idea of who's first author, second author, works directly against that in tenure processes. We need technologies. It's in technologies that we choose. Blackboard is the predominant model. It's the one we use at Syracuse for online education. It sucks. You guys use Blackboard, I take it? Yeah. You know why it sucks so much, and it's not because the icons aren't pretty? It's based on the oldest, most Victorian form of education I've ever seen. Lectures, stuff, discussion. Lectures, stuff, discussion. Well, what are you discussing? The stuff and the lectures? Can I combine them? No. Discussions happen over here. Right? It's not a form of communication. It's a form of transmittal. It's an empty bucket form of technology. If I give you my lectures and my papers, you'll learn. Because we did a really interesting thing. We had this wonderful online education summit. We were actually, it was a week-long celebration around the country highlighting online education. We said, we'll do this. What we'll do is we'll take the best lectures from our online courses and we'll put them online. They sucked. I mean, they were the most boring, disgusting, snooze-inducing lectures you've ever heard in your life. And these were from good professors who were getting good rankings out of their classes. You know why? Because when you looked at the rest of the class, the discussion boards were going crazy. The interactions were growing. They had a back-end Twitter feed. In other words, what that professor had built was a community, and I was taking the most boring part of it and highlighting it. Right? That's what we need to learn. We had implications for alumni. We don't kick them out, wait till they get famous and ask them for money. We try and keep them around. With online education, why not let them take any course they want? Why not let them sit in? Why not keep them connected? The changes of the library, that not only do we need to capture the smart people out in the world, we need to capture our own brilliance. How much of the collection of the library is from scholarship, teaching, pedagogy, research, materials, activities, projects of the students? Can I go in and see what brilliant stuff they were doing in Allied Health a year ago? Can I get a syllabus from 1992? Can I look at how we changed and shaped this? Our curriculum needs to be more modal. We need to talk about smaller chunks, 15-minute chunks, and chunks that we can vary so that the content's going to work towards visual learners, textual learners, other type of learners. The interactions with the students must be beyond the content. Context is king, not content. We see one potential future. All this discussion is about MOOCs and massively online classrooms that all UC and everyone trying to be UC is having this discussion about what happens if the world's best professor gives lectures, first of all, assuming that they're good at lectures, assuming that lectures are inappropriate. What about a model where, for example, we take the best material from these best lecturers, best teachers, best content people, and we bring them into our classroom, and that's the textbook. And our job isn't to reteach it. Our job is to help you integrate it with the rest of it and make sense of it. Interesting model, right? We hate it as faculty because we're brilliant. I'm teaching courses in library science and information reporting presentation, and I think they've even asked me to teach things in project management. I am not equally brilliant in all of those. I would much rather bring the content from someone who's brilliant, and I'll help you figure it out and imply it and work on it. But that takes a lot of faculty stepping back. Embedding. The fact is we need to go where these communities are. And that means sometimes, for example, tutors need to be in the class listening to the lectures so they're able to work on it. Librarians sometimes need to be in the class. We have many situations either physically or through Twitter streams where as I'm teaching, I run into something I don't know, don't remember, can't cite. I can quickly throw it out to Twitter or the librarian there, and by the end of the class, she's bringing back, oh, that was this, here's the citation, here's the material. We see this in medical context where medical librarians are rounding with doctors. Where doctors will say, oh, I really need to know more about that condition, that disease, whatever. The idea of students embedding within professional settings. We call them internships. Why do we give them one at the end? Why can't we have it continuous? Faculty in authentic environments, where the faculty follow the students into the internship for a week, 2 weeks, whatever, and you work together in these different environments. Now, it was mentioned that I'd worked on a mission for librarians. The mission of librarians is, so you gave away my ending, but the mission for librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in communities. I put this up, and publishers say, that's my mission. And civil servants say, that's my mission. Teachers say, that's my mission. And you know what? That's okay. I'm all right with that. Because we may have, actually if I go back this, you'll notice that there are a couple things about this mission. First of all, it's about a professional or a person mission. I used to talk about the mission of the library, the mission of the university, the mission of the university. University doesn't have a mission. It's an org chart, a budget, and a bunch of buildings that exert gravity. It's the people who work there that have the mission. Because nothing's going to happen, right? The library. Library's mission is the library can't have a mission. It has ivy and coffee bars and waiting to fall down. That's what a library does. People make connections, discussions, changes, change the world. It's the passion of individuals and the connection of individuals that make much better difference than the architecture around them. Right? So the first is it's an individual mission. The second is our means of facilitating will probably vary. Librarians will use this set of tools. Teachers will use this set of tools. IT will use this set of tools. And that's brilliant. Because in a community approach, the point is not for one person to be everything, but the person is to be a connection to a network. So if you touch anyone in the network, you get to anyone else in the network. The other is that there's a counterbalance here. It's a two-part mission. The mission is to improve society, first part, through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. This says we're all about what the community wants. This says sometimes the community wants the wrong thing. Sometimes the community wants something that they shouldn't have. So when, you know, an 8-year-old walks into a library and said, I would like the entire collection of Playboy from the past 50 years, we say no. Because as a community, but as a professional, we don't think that's the right thing to do. So there's always going to be a dialogue. This service, this mission does not say be quiet, shut up, and do what you're told. It says engage in a conversation and have an opinion. Engage in a conversation where you have a view. The community college staff, students, faculty have a view about how to make Watertown a better place. Not walking to Watertown and say, what do you want us to be? But have a dialogue to figure out what's that middle ground, what's that compromise. And yes, now it's the mission of faculty to improve society. It's the mission of tutors to come in and help us work with students. It's the mission of leadership to help us do that, to get the resources to do it. Of staff. Every staff is part of this community and important. Of IT, etc. Ultimately, what we're talking about is our mission is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation within their communities. That's what it comes down to. The community view says we are not a bunch of people walking around in our brains slightly to the left in a facility that dictates what I do. We are part of a vibrant learning community in which we learn from our students learn from us, and we all learn from the community around us, and we all are engaged. That a community is a place that a common variable brings us together. And we can do things that we never thought before because now our resources are not limited to people in this auditorium. They're as wide as the connections that we can make. And so if we go back to the Library of Alexandria, and why didn't they throw that rock? Why didn't they break that window? Because it was part of their community. They had absorbed it, they had become part of the network, and they were treasured for it. They were not a smart. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.